Omaha Public Radio presents another program for Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jeanette Eileen Jones, Associate Professor of History and Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of In Search of Brightest Africa, Reimagining the Dark Continent in American Culture, 1884 to 1936. She'll speak on the topic, Brightest Africa in the New Negro Imagination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, February 7, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
We are very honored to have Dr. Jeanette Eileen Jones, PhD, who's an Associate Professor of History and Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. She will be exploring the various ways that intellectuals, artists, and activists in the New Negro Movement between 1900 and 1930 thought about and engaged with Africa, challenging existing stereotypes of Africa as the dark continent. Their brightest Africa emerged in literature, politics, and the arts. Please welcome Dr. Jeanette Eileen Jones to the podium.
Thank you, Barbara. First, I would like to thank Barbara Velasquez for issuing an invitation for me to talk today about my research that recently culminated in the publication of my book, In Search of Brightest Africa, Reimagining the Dark Continent in American Culture, 1884 to 1936. I would also like to thank those of you who are here for attending and also to thank KIOS for recording my talk. My talk today is based on the book, but also an essay that will appear this year in an edited volume entitled Escape from New York, edited by Professors Minka Makalani of Rutgers University and DeVarian Baldwin of Trinity College. Today I'm going to talk about a facet of that research, Brightest Africa in the New Negro Imagination, focusing on mostly political and religious figures in the African-American and diasporan communities who challenged the image of Africa as a dark continent, beginning in the late 19th century and culminating in the worldwide protests against the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1936. SEFCC Hamado, writing for the Colored American magazine, declared that, quote, a new era for the colored race throughout the world, unquote, began on July 23, 1900, when people from all over the African diaspora convened the first Pan-African conference in London with the object of, quote, discussing and improving the condition of the colored race, unquote. Organized by H. Sylvester Williams and AME Zion Bishop Alexander Walters, the conference was attended by several African Americans, including W.E.B. Du Bois, Anna Julia Cooper, a Mrs. Jones of Kansas, former slave Henry Box Brown, and author D. Tobias. Walters, a former slave from Kentucky, pastored the Mount Zion Church in New York City and co-founded the National Afro-American Council with T. Thomas Fortune in 1898, serving as its first president. Williams was a Trinidadian lawyer who migrated to Canada and then to London. The conference participants discussed the global black population's deservedness and worthiness for freedom. They called attention to the lack of equal rights granted African Americans, the political and social discrimination faced by blacks in the British Empire, and the harsh labor conditions for black workers in South Africa, among other topics, arguing that, quote, the future of the race must be in the hands of the race itself, unquote. Instead of looking at whites to lead the way, the attendees argued that blacks should take additional initiatives to secure freedom and equality for all people of African descent. Nevertheless, they petitioned Queen Victoria and the British Colonial Office to take up their resolutions, which included allowing Africans access to education and participation in the colonial government, and called for the end of racial discrimination and labor exploitation in the colonies. During the conference, Tobias gave a presentation that went beyond the immediate political goals of the conveners and addressed misperceptions about Africa and Africans in the popular imagination. According to Hamadou, Tobias, quote, claimed and proved that civilization had been commenced by black men, unquote, thereby establishing a historical basis for rejecting the image of Africa as the dark continent. The conference closed with H.F. Downing stating that the black race sought freedom by deserving it and not by violent means. The newly formed Pan-African Association planned to convene a conference in the United States in 1902 and one in Haiti in 1904. As Hamadou noted, never before had that many people of African descent from around the world gathered together to discuss their political and social status as citizens of democratic republics or as imperial subjects. Convened on the basis of black brotherhood, the conference added to existing discourses among Africans in the diaspora about the political significance of Africa to their lives. Embracing Pan-Africanism, Africanism as a political position meant first acknowledging the collective plights of diaspora Africans as they encountered the color line, and second, working with other blacks to actualize self-determination. As a basis for constructing a new Negro identity, Pan-Africanism offered blacks a chance to reinvent themselves both domestically and internationally as a people of African descent invested in their brethren's lives. 16 years before the inaugural Pan-African Conference, representatives from various European nations had assembled in Berlin to carve up Africa into spheres of influence, colonies, and protectorates, ushering in a new era in Western imperialism. Although American businessmen and observers attended the conference, the United States did not express any design to join the, quote, scramble for Africa. However, many of the nation's citizens of African descent knew all too well that the events unfolding in Berlin would reverberate across the black diaspora. Black journalists, intellectuals, clergymen, and leaders decried the speed with which the continent fell under European dominance. By the turn of the century, African Americans mobilized politically and joined domestic and transnational social movements that imagined Africa free from colonial rule. Some went as far as to proclaim it, quote, the American Negro's burden, unquote, to uplift his racial brethren, and in doing so, help them take Africa back from the colonizers. In the process, African Americans contributed to a growing body of knowledge about Africa that sought to dispel the myth of darkest Africa. A new discourse emerged around the notion of a brightest Africa within the American imagination. Brightest Africa thus helped shape an anti-colonial new Negro consciousness, which included a range of political orientations but shared a belief in the ties of consanguinity between all persons of African descent. In defense of their brethren across the deep. In 1887, 2 years after the signing of the General Act of the Berlin Conference of West Africa, an editorial titled An African Empire appeared in the New York Freeman, the premier and authoritative black newspaper of Harlem, New York. Since the fateful convening of the Congo Conference in the winter of 1884 to 85, the African continent, with the exception of Ethiopia and Liberia, had come under the full control of European imperialists. The editorial explained, however, that the conference was simply a culmination of a nearly century-long process of European penetration of the continent, beginning with Mungo Park's expeditions and ending in the journeys of Henry Morgan Stanley and Pierre de Brazza. These men had, quote, completely revolutionized accepted opinions of the geography and people of Africa, unquote. Namely, that in the heart of Africa lay impenetrable jungles and monstrous peoples. While the author, most likely the newspaper's founder and editor, T. Thomas Fortune, did not explain how the partition of Africa altered those views, he predicted that the dark continent will soon hold within its grasp no secret as to its people, climate, and exhaustless and priceless resources. Declaring that, quote, Africa is the newest find, unquote, the author offered his hypothesis of why modern explorations and discoveries in Africa serve hidden interests of the Occident. Postulating that overpopulated Atlantic seaboard nations would need to close their borders to European immigrants, as they had the Pacific coast to the Chinese and the Japanese via the U.S.-Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 and immigration quotas, the author predicted that Africa would become one vast settler colony, the next objective point in the surplus population of Europe. Systematic colonization of Africa would ensue as, quote, European robbers, unquote, set their sights on the grain and gold coasts, present-day Liberia and Ghana, and the corrupt Portuguese maintained their 400-year-long presence in Africa. The British colonization of Sierra Leone, the formation of the Congo Free State, the Dutch settlement of the Transvaal Republic, and the colonial ambitions of France, Germany, and Italy only served as further evidence that Europeans intended to subject Africans to their rule. The author further explained, quote, the railroad, the steamboat, the missionary, and the rum jug have begun in earnest the conquest of the riches of Africa. The iron hill of the military despot and the oily cunning of the commercial Shylock have already shown the inborn spirit that ever propels them in the bloody wars necessary to break the independence of the people of Africa, unquote. He prophesied that the white race would use whatever means and tools necessary to render the African continent prostrate to European powers for the next 100 years. Painting an ominous picture of tyrannical European colonial officials, unscrupulous Jewish merchants, and fanatical white missionaries run amok in Africa, the author interpreted the scramble for Africa as one episode in the long history of the European quest for empire. Despite the article's rather pessimistic view of Africa's immediate political and economic future, its author expressed faith in the resilience of the African character, presumably the very character that allowed blacks to survive enslavement in the Americas. Recalling the settlement of the Americas and Australia, he prophesied that unlike the indigenous peoples of those continents, Africans would launch successful revolutions against their foreign occupiers. Quote, in the course of time, the people will become educated not only in the grasping and cruel nature of the white man, but in the knowledge of their power, the priority of ownership in the soil, and the desperation which tyranny and greed never fail to breed for their own destruction, unquote. The convolutions of the independence struggles would soon produce, quote, an African confederation that would bring freedom to the swarthy millions of the fatherland, unquote. The article went on to declare, quote, it is written on the wall that there will one day be an African empire whose extent and power will be inferior to that of no government, now denominated as a first-class power. All the indications point to this fact as one of the certainties of the future, unquote. The only thing that could prevent the inevitable, the redemption of Africa from its European usurpers, was omnipotent interposition, God himself placing himself between the colonized and the colonizer in the favor of the Africans. The editorial, The Negro's Peculiar Work, which appeared alongside An African Empire, presented the freedman's reader with a different version of Africa redeemed from colonial invasion, articulated by Reverend Joseph Charles Price, a faculty member of the Zion Wesley Institute of the AME Church in North Carolina. While the phrase New Negro had not been gained popularity at that time, it was clear that at least among religious black elites, Price represented a new black consciousness. Price's January 4, 1887 address commemorating the Emancipation Proclamation that went into effect on January 1, 1863, spoke not of the situation of Negroes in America, but of the status of the newly divided African continent. Price stated, quote, "The whites found gold, diamonds, and other riches in Africa. Why should not the Negro? Africa is their country. They should claim it. They should go to Africa, civilize those Negroes, raise them morally, and by education, show them how to obtain the wealth which is in their own country and take that grand continent as their own," unquote. Price offered a counterpart to the white man's burden, the American Negro's burden to uplift his racial brethren, and doing so, help them take Africa back from the colonizers. This Pan-Africanist vision circulated commonly among black missionaries and clergymen, especially Southerners, who inextricably linked proselytizing to Africa in Africa to the continent's political and economic independence. Price's speech received favorable reviews from the Freeman's white-owned contemporary newspaper, the New York Sun. A politically conservative paper, the Sun held that, quote, "The civilization of the native Africans by American Africans," unquote, might be the best method for developing the continent. However, the newspaper urged African Americans to take up their burden immediately as, quote, "a tremendous stream of Europeans poured into the fertile and valuable African lands, threatening eventually to overrun the whole continent for their own benefit," unquote. The Sun speculated that whether African Americans or Europeans civilized Africa, perhaps one day there would be, quote, "a Negro state that will rank with the greatest nations of the world," unquote. The New York Freeman's editorialist conceded that colored people all over the world held a vested interest in the development of Africa as it might one day provide a site for their own liberation. Believing that it might take centuries for African Americans to achieve heightened status in the United States. Nevertheless, African Americans were in the United States and had to, quote, "make the very best of the situation," unquote. The paper assured its readers, however, that in the interim, thoughtful African Americans would pay close attention to occurrences in Africa, as these events would determine both the continent's and their own futures. Indeed, over the next decade, the New York Freeman, later renamed the New York Age, and other prominent black newspapers increased their coverage of African affairs, in the process helping to shape the image of Africa in the black community and among new Negroes. Letters to the editor of the Age revealed that Africa held great importance for blacks across the United States, not just in Harlem. In March 1888, William A. Peet, a resident of Tyler, Texas, addressed the, quote, "problem of Liberia. The alleged inability of Americo-Liberians to transform the country into a leading state on the continent and to, quote, civilize," unquote, the indigenous people. Rejecting arguments that African-American immigrants were the cause of the country's downfall, Mr. Peet dismissed observers who generally regarded Liberia as a failure, and placed the blame on the inefficiency of black self-government and enterprise in civilizing and developing a country. He blamed Liberia's failure on Christianity, which he argued had a long history of standing aside while blacks fought against prejudice and political persecution. At best, Christians remained content while joining the battle after it had already begun, or they led the assault in, quote, "quixotic skirmishes against the devil," unquote. Peet argued that the increase of the African Muslim population in West Central Africa suggested that the providential mission of Christianity was not a foregone conclusion. Unless missionary efforts in Liberia worked towards the benefit of the Africans by investing capital instead of Bibles and hymnals, he saw no immediate resolution to the so-called Liberia problem. In the same 1888 issue of The Age, B. Bowser of Hartford, Connecticut, commented on his 15-year residence in Liberia. Bauer dispelled assertions that Liberians of American origins prospered and that the newly formed Liberia College was thriving. He argued that if it were not for the Aborigines, the immigrants would starve. As for the acclaimed university, it had no significant student body. Bowser painted a less flattering picture of black immigration to Liberia, noting that the average Liberian demonstrated little initiative and patience in cultivating the land. As both letters reveal, Liberia became contested ground for African Americans interested in promoting republicanism and commerce in Africa. Earlier that month, Reverend J.C. Price had declined President Grover Cleveland's appointment of him as Minister Resident and Consul General of the United States at Liberia. Price explained that he needed to dedicate his energies to the, quote, work of Negro education in the South, unquote. However, he offered this caveat, quote, "My interest, however, in Africa must not be measured by my refusal of this position. For while my work here has for its primary object the education of the Negroes and the bringing about of a better state of things in the South generally, still it also has in view as an ultimate object the enlightenment of Africa and the final redemption of the dark continent, which will be greatly advanced by the Christian education and the industrial development of the Negroes in this country," unquote. Price made explicit connection between his efforts to uplift African Americans in the South, to fashion new Negroes, as it were, and the redemption of Africa. He believed that only Christian, educated American blacks could go to Africa and enlighten its masses. Brightest Africa would emerge as a result of intra-racial Christian cooperation between Africans and their American descendants. The perceived urgency, according to some new Negroes, for African Americans to intervene in African affairs, especially those of Liberia, led to the assembling of the Congress of Africa in 1895. Under the auspices of the Stuart Missionary Foundation for Africa, the conference held in Atlanta, Georgia, was not a Pan-Africanist Congress, as Henry Sylvester Williams or W.E.B. Du Bois would later define such a gathering. The Congress on Africa brought together an interracial, that's both black and white, an international delegation to discuss the Christianization of Africa as a white and pan-African mission involving Africans in the diaspora. Nevertheless, in the face of European imperialism, the Congress served as an early site for African Americans to participate in the production and dissemination of knowledge about Africa. The gathering also provided a public space for attendees to reimagine Africa as a bright continent, its darkness extinguished by the light of Christianity, unquote. In this context, the Congress reflected the orientation of many African Americans who first articulated their Pan-Africanism in religious terms. T. Thomas Fortune attended the conference and offered his analysis of the colonization in Africa. In his address, The Nationalization of Africa, he referred to the coming of railroads, steamboats, and electricity, as well as the colonial extraction of natural resources and precious minerals as evidence of the civilization of the continent under European control. But he observed that these achievements were obtained with human blood and tears. Noting the heroism of the Ashanti and the Zulu in their recent wars with the British, Fortune claimed that Africans could not withstand the conquering forces of steam, electricity, and gunpowder forever. Quote, "If the conquest of Africa shall proceed in the next 75 years, as it has done in the past 25, the whole continent will be as completely under European control, after the lapse of a century, physically and mentally and morally, as it is possible for conquerors to impose their condition upon the conquerors. The vast population of Africa will be brought under Christian influences in new forms of government and habits of thought and of conduct. The whole life of the people will be revolutionized. Ancient beliefs and superstitions and tribal relations and dissimilarity of vernaculars will, in the course of time, be transformed entirely. The demoralizing heterogeneousness which now prevails over the whole continent will give place to a pervading homogeneity in language and religion and in government, unquote. Fortune envisioned a United States of Africa, Anglophone in language, Christian in religion, and politically aligned with the English system of civil government. He argued that Africa would follow the example of the United States when it broke away from the British Empire, projecting that, quote, the nationalization of the African Confederation will be the first step towards bringing the whole continent under one system of government, unquote. Thus, uniting Africa linguistically, religiously, and culturally became a prerequisite for effective, independent nation building. Also at the Congress, M.C.B. Mason, Assistant Corresponding Secretary of the Freedmen's Aid and Southern Education Society, offered a similar view of Africa's future, calling for African Americans to evangelize in Africa, but not to immigrate there. Emphasizing that African Americans were citizens of the United States by birth and constitutional amendment, he claimed America as their home, land, and country. Yet, he argued, quote, the obligation, my brethren, for African evangelization is nevertheless upon us. The obligation by racial affinity, by providential preparation, by special adaptation, by divine command is upon us, unquote. For Mason, race operated as an organizing principle for black unity in America and informed blacks' duty to redeem Africa. Declaring that a new era was upon American Negroes, he called forth to Africa, quote, a new day will dawn upon us, a new day for Africa and in America and for Africa beyond the seas. A new day of moral, vigorous activity. A new day whose morn shall ever be bright and whose sun shall never set. Africa, there is hope for thee. All the world is turning towards thee, and thy children from the four corners of the earth have come to bring thee light. Unquote. In return, Africa would become a haven for the world's oppressed people and feed the famished nations. Mason, like T. Thomas Fortune, imagined an enlightened Africa brought into modernity by technology and commercialized agriculture. However, for him, the continent's future political organization ranked below its religious adaptation. As V.Y. Mdibe has argued, the Pan-African invention of Africa in the late 19th century involved an intricate melding of Christian values, Western political theory, racial myths of blackness and personality, and anthropological readings of primitive cultures projected onto Africa as a promised land for African Americans and West Indians in search of political enfranchisement. Indeed, African Americans and West Indians, predominantly from Trinidad, Jamaica, and the Francophone Caribbean, exhibited increasing interest in Africa during the later half of the 19th century, often looking to it as a panacea for economic and political marginalization that they faced in the Western Hemisphere. Edward W. Blyden, considered by many scholars to be the father of Pan-Africanism, was the preeminent Pan-African intellectual of the period who fashioned diaspora backs as, quote, agents for the cultural and political modernization of Africa, unquote. Blyden, along with black leaders such as Alexander Crummell, Henry Highland Garnett, Bishop James Holly, Martin Delaney, and Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, imagine a brightest Africa uplifted through black-style Christianity and Western civilization. As David Levering Lewis states, these men were, quote, forerunners of the Pan-Africanism and black nationalism that would expand early in the next century. So let me say something a little bit about this Congress of Africa. One of the issues that we need to think about and that scholars have pointed to is why African Americans bought into these rhetorics of the superiority of Western governance as well as Christianity. And so what you see in the late 19th century is that many African Americans who are looking towards Africa are and who are visibly doing so in a lot of public spaces and seem to wield some intellectual, social, and political power are African Americans who are not interested in dealing with Africa on its own terms. They're very much about going into Africa and imposing what they see as Western African American values on the indigenous peoples. And so that's one era where they are thinking about brightest Africa as being an Africa shaped in their own image. And so my book looks critically at that. Why is that the case? Why are they not trying to go over to Africa and negotiate with Africans on their own terms, at least in the late 19th century? So now in this part, I'm going to turn to the turn of the century. So what's happening in 1900 when they convene this Congress in London? How is the vision slightly changing? That is the vision of brightest Africa. A new era for the colored race throughout the world. In 1900, Booker T. Washington, Norman Barton Wood, and Fanny Barrier Williams published A New Negro for a New Century, a book which cataloged the struggles of African Americans and their most important achievements made since emancipation. The text includes several portraits of distinguished men and women who exemplified the qualities of Washington's New Negro for the 20th century. These men and women were educated, Christian, refined, business savvy, patriotic, and proud of their heritage. The volume highlights the superb heroism of soldiers who served in the Spanish-American War, male and female educators, clergymen, and club women. Collectively, the essays in the volume discuss the roles that black men and women should take in uplifting and regenerating the race in the coming century. Arguably, the new Negroes featured in the volume were for the most part presented as apolitical. The women are noteworthy for their dedication to education and, quote, social betterment, unquote. The soldiers for their duty to the United States, perhaps the most political stance. The clergy for propagating the gospel, and men like Du Bois for furthering the higher education of Afro-Americans. No mention is made of civil rights and enfranchisement. Interestingly, Africa is only mentioned with regard to the history of slavery and the slave trade, colonization and emigration schemes, missionary activities, and vaguely colonization. The various essays in The New Negro for the New Century argue that the new Negro's relationship to Africa is remote, except for his duty to spread the gospel and prevent the importation of rum into the continent. Some 12 years later, however, Washington would convene the International Congress on the Negro, where African American and African affairs infused the agenda. Like Washington, many African Americans agreed that the turn of the century marked a sort of coming out for new Negroes. During the almost 40 years since emancipation, new Negroes had achieved some economic autonomy and adopted new strategies for self-determination. Many of these men and women resembled Reverend W.E.C. Wright's description of the new Negro in his 1894 essay, so titled. Again, they were Christian, educated, propertied, physically fit, self-reliant, and independent. These new Negroes were African Americans who claimed to be asserting a new forceful and unapologetic black identity. They were not only found in northern urban centers, later associated with the new Negro movement of the 20s and 30s, and here I'm thinking about Harlem and Chicago, but across the nation in the urban and rural South, Midwest, West, and Pacific Coast. In these spaces, new Negro identities became more stridently political as blacks expressed concerns about the reign of Jim Crow, white terrorism and lawlessness, black disenfranchisement, and debt peonage under the sharecropping systems. National black organizations had begun emerging in the late 19th century with the Afro-American League in 1889 and the National Association for Colored Women, the NACW, in 1896, among others. However, after the turn of the century, two major organizations were founded, the NAACP in 1909 as a successor to the defunct Niagara Movement, and the National League of Urban Conditions Among Negroes, which we call the National Urban League, in 1910. These two groups arose not simply to combat what many African Americans and their white allies saw as Booker T. Washington's accommodationist ideology on race relations, but to address the political, social, and economic realities of black life in America. For the most part, these leading new Negro organizations maintained a domestic focus, although several of their members and leaders had already joined internationalist movements and organizations with Pan-Africanist agendas. New Negro identities and Pan-Africanism intersected in African-American anti-colonialist and emigrationist so-called Black Back to Africa movements. As part of a larger phenomenon of black internationalism discussed by scholars Brent Edwards Hayes, Kate A. Baldwin, Robin D.G. Kelly, among others. While Edwards focuses on black internationalist initiatives in the early 20th century, particularly during the interwar years, and the significance of Paris to the Pan-African literary and anti-colonial enterprises, he acknowledges that the linking of blacks in the diaspora began before 1900, before the inaugural Pan-African Congress. However, 1900 signaled a new era in African-American politics and engagement with Africa as a physical, geographical, and intellectual construct. Brenda Gale Plummer notes that the Pan-African Congress constituted an international response to the new imperialism of the late 19th century and the disenfranchisement of African-Americans, the political unrest in the Caribbean colonies, and the declining status of persons of African descent in Latin America. Although Pan-Africanism involved a good deal of myth-making and the reimagining of Africa as a new Canaan, real political commitments to anti-colonialism and black self-determination stimulated rural, working class, and elite African Americans alike. Stirred by W.E.B. Du Bois' proclamation that, quote, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, unquote, elite African-American Pan-Africanists embarked on what David Levering Lewis describes as a, quote, inherently revolutionary Pan-African idea that was bound to take on a life of its own, unquote. Yet Pan-Africanism would become a grassroots movement, and Marcus Garvey would amass the largest Pan-Africanist following outside of elite circles. So while many people thought this movement would be led by elites, later on when Garvey comes to the United States from Jamaica, he's able to mobilize rural people in the South, urban working class people, as well as elites. So it's a more egalitarian movement in that sense. When the International Congress on the Negro convened at the Tuskegee Institute in April 1912, Liberia and Abyssinia, Ethiopia, remained the only independent African states, as Morocco had signed the Treaty of Fez in March, making it an official French protectorate. According to the Chicago Defender, Washington called the conference to, quote, bring about an exchange of ideas among those who are working for the uplift of the black race throughout the world, unquote. In 1899, Washington had negotiated with the German Empire to embark on a cotton cultivation and vocational training program in Togoland. And let me say, there's a good book that just recently came out called Alabama in Africa, and it's about the German Empire, Booker T. Washington, and the negotiation for this cotton-growing project in German Togo. So anyway, the Congress that was called conference in 1912 appeared to be a follow-up on that initiative in Africa. Attended by representatives from missionary societies, several countries from the Western Hemisphere, including Jamaica, Puerto Rico, the Danish West Indies, and Venezuela, Europe, and eight states or provinces from Africa, including Liberia and South Africa, the conference represented the first Pan-African gathering of the new century held on American soil. Washington demonstrated a marked consistency in his promotion of industrial education for the new Negro. As expressed in his 1906 article, Industrial Education in Africa, he wanted to ascertain whether or not the curricula taught at Tuskegee Institute and Hampton Institute could aid in the uplift of Africans, particularly those under colonial rule. Washington sought not only an international venue to promote his politics of black self-determination, but also a platform to shape African-American ideas about Africa. In many ways, this conference foreshadowed a changing of the political guard in the black community, as well as the Pan-Africanist rank and file. The Victorian values that infused the Congress of Africa in 1895 and Washington's International Congress of the Negro faded as Pan-Africanists assumed a more aggressive stance, which downplayed the role of white philanthropists and missionaries in the redemption of Africa. This transformation from accommodationist politics, which emphasized cooperation between peoples of African descent and, quote, white well-wishers of the race, to a more radical and revolutionary activism that celebrated blackness and demanded black and African independence. In this sense, it mirrored the shift in the Pan-Africanist image of Africa from a dark continent to a land of enlightenment. In 1911, Washington issued an official announcement for the conference in which he would state his goal was to foster dialogue not only blacks, but also government representatives of African colonies to discuss methods for educating and upbuilding Negro peoples. Like self-proclaimed Pan-Africanists, he viewed the situation of African Americans and West Indians as related to, quote, the problems of Africa, unquote. While he did not call for deliberations on African independence, he invited the participation of missionaries, workers, and anyone who could bring empirical knowledge of the African diaspora to bear on the conference proceedings. Washington received enthusiastic responses from many Africans, including members of the Ethiopian Church in South Africa, who planned to attend the conference. So let me just summarize. The conference included several people, and they pretty much met over a course of a week and decided that the best tract was for African Americans and their allies to try to work with the colonial powers, that is to negotiate with them to, quote, uplift or upbuild Negroes in Africa. And that's pretty much the standard. And then, of course, Garvey comes to America about 3 years later, and he had started his organization, the UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association, in Jamaica, but then decided that it was best to bring that movement to the United States, where he could be in contact with more working-class African-Americans in a larger geographical space. His headquarters would be in Harlem, New York. And as we all know, Garvey's brand of Pan-Africanism was not about negotiating in any manner, or at least in a limited manner, with the colonial powers. He wanted Africans in the diaspora, particularly those in the U.S. and those in the West Indies, the Anglophone West Indies, but also those who were in the French West Indies as well, to spearhead the movement to take Africa back from what he called the white usurpers. And this is language that you see not only among Garvey, but other Pan-Africanists. And one of the things that Garvey emphasized is that the members of his organization were not, quote, Bolshevik, IWW, Democrat, Republican, or Socialist, that they were actually not affiliated with any of these political movements and groups and organizations or parties that he saw as white-dominated. He said his group is pro-Negro. He disavowed any connection to political parties and labor unions dominated by whites, but he did not discard the idea that Republican government and the democratic political processes could best uplift Africa. So the thing that distinguishes Garvey from, even though he looked to Booker T. Washington, Washington's form of Pan-Africanism is that he really wanted African-Americans and Africans in the diaspora to be independent in formulating their own plans for uplifting Africa. And then, of course, Du Bois, as we know, is in many ways considered not only the counterpart to Washington in terms of strategies for uplifting African Americans at home, but also a counterpart to Marcus Garvey in their iterations of Pan-Africanism. Du Bois's Pan-African movement was in many ways similar to Garvey. He believed that Africa needed to be free of colonial powers, but he didn't believe that that was an immediate goal, where Garvey said that Africa should be immediately released from colonization. Du Bois believed that measures had to be more needed to be taken that were less strident and that would unfold over a series of years. And what's interesting about Du Bois is that, of course, over the years, he becomes more and more radical in his Pan-Africanism. So initially, he has that kind of accommodationist view. Let's see how we can negotiate with the colonial powers. Let's see what small concessions they're willing to give the colonized Africans. And then he becomes more affiliated with the left politically, embracing certain aspects of socialist and communist doctrines. And he becomes more strident in his Pan-Africanism. And eventually, I'm going to end with his talk, but eventually, as we know, he basically emigrates to Ghana. He's buried there now. He renounces his U.S. citizen and dies a citizen of the country of Ghana. And in many ways, this was kind of the culmination of his Pan-African vision that Africa needed to be released from colonial rule, and it was fitting that he went to the first country that found independence under Kwame Nkrumah. So let me talk a little bit about the African Blood Brotherhood, which many people are not familiar with, but some of you will. It was founded in 1918 by Cyril Briggs, and many of those members had been part of Garvey's UNIA. But the reason why Briggs and others broke away from the Garvey movement is that they felt that the Republican vision, that is the vision of Africa as having little republics like the United States, was not the vision for Africa. In fact, they believed that the only type of government that would benefit the African continent were socialist or communist governments, and so they broke away. Cyril Briggs drew parallels between the oppression of blacks in America and Africans under colonial regimes like the other Pan-Africanists, but again, they wanted their plan to be more communalistic. In 1922, the African Blood Brotherhood issued its most comprehensive Pan-Africanist program, in which it committed itself to defending Africans from imperialist aggression. Published in the Communist Review, the organ of the Communist Party of Great Britain, the African Blood Brotherhood outlined a plan for the liberation of all people of African descent, based on the premise that their struggle was primarily economic, the result of white capitalist exploitation of black labor around the world. So not just in Africa, but any place that black people were, they were under white capitalist exploitation. The organization explained that it looked towards Soviet Russia for inspiration, not solely because of its political system, but also because it opposed the imperialist robbers who had portioned our motherland and subjugated our kindred. That's a direct quote. Briggs and his followers maintained that the Soviets instilled fear in capitalists and imperialists alike, and thus communism offered the best solution for liberating blacks. The first item on the ABB platform was our motherland, Africa, giving the continent a prominence that contrasted the platform of other mainstream organizations that ranked the American Negro problem above all race considerations. So if you would look at other platforms, it would be the American Negro problem, and then maybe Africa would be three or fourth or fifth. The ABB's platform had Africa front and center. The ABB referred to the European nations controlling Africa as big capitalist powers that established colonies under the management of planters and capitalist merchants who expropriated African lands, exploited the continent's natural resources, and forced Africans to work for starvation wages. In narrating the, quote, covetous and murderous inhumanity of capitalism and imperialism in Africa, unquote, the ABB overturned the colonial myth that Africans acquiesced to this domination via faithfully negotiated treaties and military alliances. The organization explained that Africans rebelled and fought the invader in an unequal struggle, where their primitive and old weapons offered no match for the modern technologies and weaponry of the Europeans. Yet insisting that Africans fought to the death, taking many a British square, that's a formation of troops, the ABBB reclaimed African manhood and warned that the spirit of rebellion festered in Africans who would one day secure their freedom and take back their motherland. In the intervening period, Europeans would continue to squelch the militant spirit of Africans with Christianity and whiskey while they introduced material improvements to the land, like the railroad. They went on to later explain that this would prove to be the imperialist undoing, as Africans mastered European technology, including the gun, with the one goal of one day overthrowing white rule. So let me sum up their platform quickly and then read the last part from Du Bois's seminal article. The ABB called for an end to the rhetoric. And for them, they thought that many of the movements that you saw in the United States, but also some of those in Europe, were mainly movements ran by people who could give good speeches. There were public performances, endless parades, and what they called other tomfoolery, but that there were no proper tactics being adopted by these groups to defeat capitalists and imperialists oppressing Africa. And so they called for an alliance with the Third International, criticizing the tactics of not only Garvey's UNIA, but also the Pan-African Congresses led by Du Bois. The transnational scope of the Pan-African Congresses, as well as the UNIA, did not, in their mind, offer a counterpart for, or a good counterpart for counterpart for African redemption. So, conclusion, Brightest Africa for Bright Africans. Du Bois' seminal 1933 essay, Pan-Africa and the New Racial Philosophy, and subsequent writings on the theory of colonial imperialism encapsulated the new marriage of traditional Pan-Africanism, a kind that we saw emerging in the late 19th century, anti-imperialism in a global context, and workers' rights. So the things that ABEB was talking about, and then those African-Americans who joined both the Communist and the Socialist parties. Du Bois argued that the so-called Negro problem had to be approached not from a, quote, narrow provincial or even national background, but in relation to the great problem of the color races of the world, and particularly those of African descent, unquote. Although he had made a similar argument in The Souls of Black Folk, he had yet to articulate his concept of the color line in the framework of a radical Pan-Africanism inflected by leftist philosophies. Du Bois employed African Americans to cease thinking of themselves as, quote, belonging to the white race, unquote. He argued that despite the fact that by birth African Americans were American, in reality, their experiences resonated with those of the dark people outside of America than their own fellow white citizens. Citing color caste discrimination and labor exploitation as experiential links between African Americans and the colored peoples of Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia, he called for, quote, spiritual sympathy and intellectual cooperation in working towards the freedom of the human spirit encased in dark skin, unquote, and for the dismantling of the economic and political system that deprived these persons of their humanities. Du Bois believed that new Negroes had to take the lead in addressing the problems of the colored peoples of the world first by embracing Pan-Africanism. In explaining the new racial philosophy for Pan-Africanists, he returned to the idea of black self-governance and the need to reject stereotypes of Africans. He asked African Americans to conduct a, quote, spiritual house cleaning, unquote, where they would cease to think of Liberia and Haiti as failures in government, of American Negroes as being engaged principally in partying and frequenting cabarets, and of West Indians as ineffective talkers, and of West Africans parading around in their breechcloths. Du Bois emphasized race pride as a rallying cry for African Americans to move beyond their color and nationalist prejudices that they had inherited from white Americans, and instead to embrace their mission to help emancipate the colored peoples of the world. Du Bois postulated that the champion of Africa required not only political action, but a reimagining of the black self as a proud descendant of brightest Africa, the motherland. The transition from the missionary and emigrationist Pan-African movements of the late 19th century to the Pan-African conferences of the early 20th century, to the Garveyism of the 1920s, and finally to the radical Pan-Africanism and internationalism of the 1930s, is critical to understanding the various ways that new Negroes imagined a brightest Africa. As African Americans saw themselves as throwing off the vestiges of the old Negro, benighted as a result of centuries of enslavement, they began making themselves over as modern. As modern Negroes, they claimed their Americanness and their special relationship with Africa as descendants of Africa's stolen brethren. Responding to new European attacks on their motherland, these men and women embraced a new solidarity with the people in the continent. In the process of imagining an independent, modern Africa, new Negroes began dismantling images of Africa as a dark continent at multiple sites of knowledge production. For them, brightest Africa was on the horizon. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jeanette Eileen Jones, Associate Professor of History and Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of In Search of Brightest Africa, Reimagining the Dark Continent in American Culture, 1884 to 1936. She spoke on the topic, Brightest Africa in the New Negro Imagination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, February 7th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.